If you wanted to learn about Bitcoin from the guy who has read more about it than anybody else you know, well, you've come to the right place. This is a Guy's Take episode. Nick Carter's article, a most peaceful revolution that we covered a day or two ago, really put into words a lot of things that, like I knew, like some of the things that like felt really fundamental. It's one of those things where when you hear it said in a certain way, you're like, ah, that's what was, you know, hanging on the end of my tongue that I couldn't quite get out. And this, the article was just full of so many of those little moments for me. But it really sets a really important question, is what exactly makes Bitcoin a revolution? And he goes through such a powerful position of why it is, and that this is not just a technological revolution. It is, to some degree, it's a technological invention, but it is a technology that enables a political and social revolution. And that's what we are going to talk about today. This is The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. Welcome back to the show. I'm going to call this a Guy's Take episode, even though it's technically the commentary of A Most Peaceful Revolution, but I'm going to be going off the rails here quite a bit, I think. I will be responding to a lot, and we'll be letting Nick Carter lead us through this discussion, but there's so much I want to hit here that I just think is incredibly important and just a really fascinating concept to explore. So that's what we're going to do. So when we say Bitcoin is a revolution and it's a political and social one, when it is clearly a piece of technology, what does Nick mean by this? What does that mean? So I think the first place to look is just the history of Bitcoin, like the 20 years leading up, well, really the 40 or 50 years, arguably, if you go back to, if you take kind of the origins that the iterative capital thesis does, which is a four-hour piece of absolute magic. If you have not listened to that one yet or read that one, definitely go back. I'll make sure to put in the show notes the link to the iterative capital thesis. It's such a great thing, and it's just all about what's driving the cryptocurrency phenomenon, and it really starts with the absolute underbelly, the very beginnings of the open source movement, and the dichotomy between the sort of corporate structure and the engineering, like, let's solve the problem as quickly as possible, like, incentive, and how those diverged during the proliferation of these new systems and sorts of organization throughout our society, and that essentially we are moving into a post-corporate world. And the open source and all of these major, the cyberspace environment and the idea of the internet is an extension of that, that we are becoming more and more decentralized and less centered around a specific hierarchical structure and figuring out how to organize better using those means, using those sorts of interactions between people. It's just absolutely fascinating concept and such a good piece. Really foundational to this whole concept. But you go back and you look at this history. This started with the cypherpunks. And if you go back, there's the Cypherpunk Manifesto, in fact. We covered that on episode 163, or quick read 163. An absolute brilliant one. And then you've got the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto, who is by Timothy May, the veritable cypherpunk godfather. The Cypherpunk's Manifesto was done by Eric Hughes. Yes, Eric Hughes. But I got a quote from the manifesto, the Cypherpunk Manifesto. It says, quote, "We cannot expect governments, corporations, or other large faceless organizations to grant us privacy out of their beneficence. It is to their advantage to speak of us, and we should expect that they will speak. To try to prevent their speech is to fight against the realities of information. Information does not just want to be free, it longs to be free. And he's setting up this dichotomy that this is an this is a extra governmental, extra corporate independence that we are trying to set up. And that's actually where we got the term cypherpunks write code. And that was a manifesto about we are going to get back our privacy and our independence in exchanging information and exchanging value, which he alludes to. But the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto, another cypherpunk, Timothy May, basically extended the same idea. And this was written back in 1988. I can't remember when the Cypherpunk Manifesto was written, but if you listen to the episode, I know I go through it. But this is from the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto in, again, 1988. Quote, "Just as the technology of printing altered and reduced the power of medieval guilds and the social power structure, so too will cryptologic methods fundamentally alter the nature of corporations and of government interference in economic transactions." And he even talks about how, like, you'll be able to have contracts and exchange with people who you do not know. You don't know their name. You don't know how trustworthy they are because you'll be able to trust the contract. There's so much prescience in kind of the systems that will arise from this technology. And here, all they really have to go from is public-private key cryptography. They just extrapolate that, okay, we're going to create transaction systems. We're going to create a value exchange and trust system that is external to the state and to corporate structure. We are not going to have to rely on third parties. That this is just inevitable. 40 years ago. That's great. Well, no, 30 years ago, 31 years ago. That's crazy. This foundation has been laying for a long time. And these are the people who worked day and night to expand this technology and figure out how to build all of the pieces, all of the forefathers that led to Bitcoin. This is where it comes from. It was always about creating a a flat, independent, non-state. It was about the separation of money and state, the separation of money and, information and state. It was about freeing people in cyberspace, in this new realm, building technologies that freed people from the restrictions of the systems that are run by other people, that are permissioned, that are surveilled, and that are dependent on the trust of some other institution not involved in the transaction. That is always what this has been about, and it is a deeply political and social revolution. The technology is simply the tool that facilitates it. I actually haven't done the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto on the show. I thought I had, but I had not. I might actually do that one pretty soon. I'm going to put that in my lineup, so keep an ear out for that one. It's really short. You can read it in 2 minutes. I'll link to it in the show notes as well. But the very core of what makes a nation state, like, we have to really get at what a nation state is. Like, what do we mean when we say the separation of money and state? Well, the state, the foundation on which it derives every other authority that it has, is a moral exception to ignore property rights. And supposedly, in the name of keeping everybody safe and securing property rights, which we won't go into the ridiculous contradiction there, but that is essentially what it is. Everything else is just an extension of that single power. It is the power to confiscate resources. It is the moral exception to confiscate resources. And that it happens typically through taxation, inflation, deficits, fractional reserve banking, whatever system it is. There are many systems involved in this exact same process, or in this exact same end, but that is what they all amount to. It's the confiscation of resources from the people who have earned and produced it, the value that they have produced into the world without having to ask or receive consent of any kind. In doing so, the state is the final arbiter on, and that this is important, they are the final, they have the last say on who owns what. And that last say is backed up. That final arbitration is backed up by military and violent action, whether it's for the police, by the police, the prison system, or the military. That is always the end result of any incomplete dispute. It ends at violence. All the rest of it is just window dressing on what is used to create the final final end result. Violence is the beating heart of the state institution, that they are the ones who can force your neighbor to do something, whereas you and none of your other neighbors have that authority. And most people refuse to admit that this is true. But it's not really even ignored. It's actually glorified. It's just mostly thought of as acceptable. Like, it's part of our, we grow up in this system. Well, that's the norm. And of course, that's how it works. How would you do it if you weren't just forcing people to all invest in the same thing, or confiscating resources from obviously all the people who don't know how to spend it? It just becomes this like thing. It's like, well, yeah, duh. That's just how things are. And not only is it glorified, there's like incredible pride in being willing to go to the most absolute ends to maintain the facade. Watch that Rudy Giuliani video, man. Like, watch that thing that I retweeted. It'll creep you out. It's really a crazy, like, fundamental position that they start from. And I was there. Like, it's not as if I was immune to it. Like, obviously, that's how I grew up. It took years and years and years of study and arguing with myself, and feeling extremely uncomfortable about ideas that I was entertaining, that was, in fact, a deeply immoral and incorrect way to think about the world. A fascinating piece. Actually, let me drop another suggestion for a read here. Anatomy of the State by Rothbard is a crazy piece that is probably going to blow your mind if you're just getting into these ideas, and they're probably a little bit out there. So definitely go check that one out. I will be adding that one to the show notes too. But the fundamental nature of Bitcoin, so that's the fundamental nature of the state, is that it is the final arbiter on property rights, and there is no challenging it. To challenge it is essentially to commit suicide, or it is to position yourself in the system in such a way, it is to alter your position in it so that you can now morally be murdered. If you refuse to the end, it is that you will be killed. If you don't pay the bill that they then send you when you refuse to pay for, you know, I don't want to pay for a bomb in Iraq. If I refuse to do it and they caught me and realized that that's what I was doing, well, they would send me a bill for twice the amount that I supposedly owed. And then they would send police to enforce it, or they would try to confiscate it from my bank account. If I refused then and made it hard for them to access the money, well, then they would send police and they would try to confiscate it from me. They would drag me into a court and declare that I was to be shamed and publicly ridiculed and my life was over, and they were going to put me in a cage. And if I refuse to go into a cage, if I resist those police doing that and torturing me and putting me in a cement box for the rest of my life, well, then I will be beaten. If I continue to fight back, I will be shot. Like, that is the end result of my not wanting to pay for a bomb that kills people in Iraq. I am forfeiting my life within the rules of the system. The supposed morals inside of the structure are whether or not I am following the authority, not whether or not I have done something that we can establish is immoral or infringing upon someone else's rights. Yet within Bitcoin, Bitcoin is the final arbiter, regardless, completely independently of the state or any corporate intermediary. And that's without allowing any exception for the state rule. There's no exception in Bitcoin. Everyone is totally on the same playing field. There is no single point of permissiveness. There is no single point of control. It is 100% independent and external to the state's property rights system. They are no longer, this is the first technology that has ever truly challenged the state's position as the final arbiter of property rights. And it does so with the security of cryptography, which the state has no tool to fight against. No real tool, no fundamental I can break it tool. Whereas in a social hierarchy structure, violence is the tool that breaks the end game of like me, like my personal defense as the final arbiter of property rights, is that, well, they will just overwhelm me with their violence. You know, when I have just one person with a gun, like I just have my own defense of my property or something, well, they will just get 50 people with guns and overwhelm me. They cannot do that with my cryptographic defense. They do have some tools, but the balance of power is vastly different between my ability to defend my life and liberty just in a physical sense versus the power of being able to cryptographically secure that ownership or that value. But this isn't like Bitcoin isn't a trimming at the leaves of the state or like getting all those extra too long branches. It truly attacks the roots of what makes the system possible. It alters the fundamental rules. Now, that doesn't mean taxation becomes impossible, because taxation is enforced or excused because the state is a form of religion, essentially. It is that priestly exception that some do not have to follow the same rules as others, that there is an authoritative structure, and it is fundamentally about inequality being institutionalized. That this special group of persons have some divine right to violate the basic moral principles of don't hurt people and don't take their stuff in order to achieve some utilitarian outcome, even if it's something as arbitrary as, you know, the totally inconsequential banning of plastic straws so that we're using paper straws in our big plastic cups in a city with millions of plastic heroin syringes being handed out and littering the ground. Like, it doesn't matter how arbitrary it is, or even if that utilitarian purpose totally fails, the state is still the only one in the position to actually do something to violate that basic moral principle. Now, most statists and myself, back when I would hear these arguments, will bristle like crazy about that statement that it is a religion. And I'm so sorry if I've made someone uncomfortable, but it's true. You know, a story told by police is trusted by default. A story told by a citizen who has been beaten senseless by that officer better have a full high-definition video proving it, or it won't even be considered. And even with perfect video, the overwhelming majority will just excuse the extreme violence because, oh, they were scared or confused. But no one can explain why police are somehow different people. I mean, I have a number of friends who either have been police officers in the past or still are. And you know what? They're not a damn bit different than any of my other friends. Except arguably, and one could say that maybe this was a natural tendency or this was actually a consequence of them becoming officers, I would argue that they were probably a little bit more arrogant and kind of chest puffy, if I'm being honest. Like, I don't doubt most of them really like being cops because it probably makes them feel incredibly powerful. And I don't care who you are, it feels good to be the most powerful person in the room. That is another part of human nature. It is not something, for the same reason it feels good to be the most powerful person in the room, it feels bad to be the weakest and most subservient person in the room. So both of them are derivatives of the exact same nature. So if you're arguing that people don't feel good when they're powerful, you're arguing that people don't feel bad when they're powerless, which I think is so obviously not true that there's no argument there. And so this will, that level of power, that authority, those positions of moral exclusiveness will go to everyone's head in some way. I mean, the highest demographic of people who physically abuse their spouses are police officers. That's just a statement of fact. And the excuse that they have I've literally heard people be like, well, they have a dangerous job. That's bullshit, because construction work is still the most dangerous job in the country. You are more likely to be injured or killed than being a police officer. And no one would ever excuse a construction worker going home and beating his wife senseless just because their job is stressful. Again, it's about a moral exception of some presumed priestly level of authority that they have that people external to that position do not have. And that goes all, that's just police, but it goes all the way up. I mean, which one of your friends has the right to take money from your bank account so that they can invest your money into the retirement plan they think you should have? That is the whole concept of government, is that they are going to use our resources for the policy, the healthcare policy we should have, or the retirement plan we should have, or the whatever, anything. That is the foundation of everything that the government does. It's a utilitarian argument that the morality of what they do is less important than the supposed utilitarian result of their violation of that morality. That exception is 100% for political masters and no one else. And the difference is not small. Like the divergence between those two rights is not like some minor difference. It's not like one group can do it and the other group just has to refrain. A normal person doing the exact same thing that the government demands gratitude for is... A normal person doing it is considered an absolute criminal, is immediately derided as the worst sort of humanity, is publicly shamed, killed or left to rot and tortured in a cement box for the rest of their lives. The closer they get to achieving the level of theft and non-consented control over other people as the state, the closer they get to doing as much control and damage as the state, the more the normal person is derided and the more blessed and gratitude the state deserves for the exact same act. And, you know, the state goes off and kills hundreds of thousands of people in the Middle East, supports and enforces sanctions, starving millions of people in Yemen and Iran, numerous other countries, and you got 40 or 50 years to work from. I mean, Vietnam, the sanctions on Iraq that supposedly resulted in result in the deaths of 250,000 children. 250,000 children. And Madeleine Albright says, we think the price is worth it. Bitcoin is a complete rejection of the entire structure. With Bitcoin as a final arbiter for value and ownership, everything that is taken to the Bitcoin court, to the network, is entirely extrajudicial and has not the slightest clue or concern about what the political structure requires of, or what the political structure demands is the actual owner. Nick Carter mentioned it in his piece about Hasu's great piece on independent property rights, and that what really breaking into the core of what Bitcoin is competing with. And that is the structure. That's what Bitcoin is competing with. It is the final arbiter of property rights within the system and any system or extension of it built on top of it that refers to Bitcoin as the settlement and court for the final ownership of coins. It is not your keys, not your coins. If they are your keys, they are yours regardless of the president, of Congress, of Parliament, of authoritarian regime A, B, C, or D, is all irrelevant. There's no borders. It doesn't have a clue that you sent it to Venezuela, even though Venezuela has capital controls. The same keys are the same in Venezuela as they are in the U.S., as they are in Canada. Every jurisdiction you can unlock it in any jurisdiction that just has a connection to the internet, whether it be by satellite, by radio, by broadband, et cetera, et cetera. It does not matter. The Bitcoin system is ubiquitous and in consensus across all of them. And that's what this is about. That's what makes it a revolution. It's not even a small revolution. It is a profound shift in the dynamics of power to protect individual sovereignty and the rights of individual value, ownership, and exchange at a fundamental level. It is first and foremost a political revolution. All right. So I haven't really talked much about the article. I've referenced a couple of things, but this is basically my thoughts from the first paragraph of this thing. So let's go ahead and hit our sponsor. We're already pretty deep into this. And I will go back and we'll continue through this article because there's so much more just amazing stuff to cover in this. And I love this entire concept. And there is so many little diamonds in the rough in this article. I got so many quotes to go through. Let's hit our sponsor and we'll jump right back in. I truly think the fundamental argument here is a moral one. And that's why like so many people will debate with me about statism and think that they're going to come up with some really clever utilitarian example for why the state should have this moral exception when the whole foundation of why I no longer believe in it. Not only do I think those utilitarian arguments are misunderstandings of long-term consequences of enabling immoral action, but it's also a moral argument that is the foundation of what led me away from the state as any arbiter of anything. It was really, really hard. Like when I say the state is a religion, I know how much that probably triggers people because I remember how hard it triggered me when I had someone tell me that. And I was just, it's incredibly hard to come to terms. Like most people, it's never something that's entertained. You just don't think about it. Like I felt honor. Like I felt like incredibly emotionally connected to, you know, the national anthem, the flag, like putting my hand over my heart. Like I'd get the goosebumps when somebody really sang the national anthem. And like, it was part of who I was. 15 years ago, I probably like that Rudy Giuliani video that like creeps me out now. I probably would have gotten jacked at watching that video 15 years ago. I probably would have been like, hell yeah, defend the country, America, my America. So when some debate is trying to give me some utilitarian argument for the state, I truly see it as it's going to have a similar effect on me as trying to explain to an abolitionist that, oh my God, well, what about the price of cotton if we free the slaves? From my opinion, who cares? Like, this is a moral argument. It's our responsibility. It's got nothing to do with the like, we don't get to just make slaves. It's our responsibility to figure out how to produce cotton absent, like morally. It's our obligation to do it morally. The simple fact is that the ends are deeply tied to the means. If we think about this, like the violation of these basic and obvious morals, I truly don't believe there is any way for it to have a net benefit, even if we are talking about a short-term utilitarian purpose, because at the core of your action, what you are doing is normalizing and desensitizing the people to the concept of acting immorally if it's an excuse that's good enough for whatever the end is. And there is a network effect. There's a consequence. There's a social consequence to absolutely everything that we do. If there's one person acting courageously or standing up for themselves or speaking out while everyone else is being quiet, we know and we regularly think of or somebody who like donates or does something nice for someone else, it very well may infect 10 other people with the idea that, okay, I should be more brave. I should try to be more objective. I should speak out when I know something is wrong. Similarly, if someone acts immorally to achieve some utilitarian purpose and then is rewarded for it because of the supposed ends that justified that terrible action, well, then in the same way, 10 others will be infected with the idea that, oh, well, why didn't we do it for our retirement accounts? Why don't we just take money from these people? Because I can obviously spend it better than they could. Why not use inflation to create the best insurance policy ever? That's free, quote unquote, when we just don't understand what the hell money is. All it does is spread the disease of thinking of immoral solutions to our problems because we've set the precedent of valuing the utilitarian end above the correctness of the means of actually treating each other with respect and as human individuals. So you just end up being like, oh, well, what's good enough to would just completely disregard the morality of their actions. Like, it just becomes an institutionalized immorality to achieve whatever it is, a low-cost healthcare or a really decent retirement plan or stupid plastic straws and blah, blah, blah. Like, it just, it always ends up holding the end as a higher purpose than the original action. It becomes a, well, yeah, he murdered seven people, but look how clean the streets are. You know, like, you just end up, like, excusing ridiculous things like 250,000 children starving to death in Iraq and being like, oh, well, the regime is a little bit weaker than it was a couple of years ago, so we think it's worth it. Like, it becomes so utterly insane the more those actions and eventual ends stack on top of each other, and the network effect spreads, and it ends up just a complete loss of morality throughout society, is that everybody just looks to the state and political intervention and is no longer concerned about cooperating with their neighbor or treating them as individuals who own their own stuff. Like, everybody is just at each other's throats all the time, and then politics becomes the center of the whole world because, God forbid, somebody else get their candidate in because it's in charge of, now politics is in charge of my healthcare, it's in charge of my insurance policy, it's in charge of my, which car I buy, it's in charge of which straw I put in my drink. I mean, it becomes so micromanaged that to avoid politics, to avoid the political system specifically, is to just leave yourself at the mercy of every other person who doesn't care, you know, how much you're forced to pay. And then you have to also have to consider something else, that 90% of business enterprises fail. If 90% of business enterprise fails, so too will 90% of political enterprise. And I think that's being extra conservative in just saying that they're equal, because people who have no skin in the game will not produce the same ratio of successful projects. They will be far less successful. I bet it's closer to 99% of political enterprises fail at the job they are intended to complete. So not only have we now justified the ends, we don't even reach the ends well over 90% of the time, but we are still engaging in the immoral means to get there constantly. So when they fail, they do it on the backs of a mountain of theft, police force, imprisonment of thousands who had nothing to do with it or maybe even never even wanted to be a part of it. While a business fails on the back of the direct investors or the incorrect or irresponsible decisions of the people involved in that enterprise only, the people who own it, and they pay the costs and the risks, and practically no one else is part of the consequences without choosing for themselves to be involved. It's voluntary and cooperative action, whereas everybody else is like when Social Security falls apart, I'm stuck. You know, I've been paying into it ever since I got my first job, but I know I'm not getting a dime out of Social Security. I know that thing is done before I ever withdraw from it, and I'm screwed. I have no, again, I can't refuse to pay for it. I absolutely 100% am certain that is a completely failed project that is sucking up not 7%, but 15% of what I could earn in a job because the employer just pays me 7% less when they have to equal that on there. It just becomes a cost for hiring someone. So I'm losing 15% of the value that I produce for a retirement plan that will not pay me a gallon of milk's worth of value in 40 years. Okay, I've gone way too far into this, but let's get back to Nick Carter's article. The next section I want to get into is just the concept of new warfare. And this was a really brief section. But this is really in line with The Sovereign Individual, which is one of the most fascinating books expanding on this concept and talking about the dynamic of and the dynamics and payoffs of the use of violence to control people. And there's an Audible an audio book coming on Audible, so you can actually pre-order it now. So if you have not read The Sovereign Individual, you are in luck. There is an 18-hour audiobook coming very soon, and I highly, highly recommend it. So if you don't have like an Audible account or you haven't purchased your copy, your pre-order, I definitely, definitely recommend it. It's so good. But warfare really is. It's moving into the digital realm. I mean, WikiLeaks is at war with major corrupt national and corporate institutions. Hackers play a significant role in the global political landscape, and that is both state-funded hackers and just underground journalists or data leakers or just random kids in their garage who are really pissed off about something and want to hack a police station website or flood some servers of some company or institution or something somewhere with a DDoS attack. If you haven't done any like reading or exploring on the insane design of the Stuxnet virus, or just on the history of WikiLeaks and like hackers and stuff, you've really got to. Another just brilliant, just fascinating, fascinating exploration of history. I recommend, another one on the Bitcoin Survivors book list. Go check out the Bitcoin Survivors book list. There's so many great things up there. But This Machine Kills Secrets, it's kind of about the foundations of WikiLeaks and the history of hackers. You can get it all on thecryptoeconomy.com. And the book list is, you'll see it, the Bitcoin Survivors book list is just in the menu up at the top. But Bitcoin is a major part of this war. Currency has always played an astoundingly important role in warfare. Even in physical and historical warfare, currency was always had a critical role. Without a strong currency, you have no purchasing power. Without purchasing power, you have no soldiers, you have no police. Literally, without control of the currency, you have no means of control. Because all of our economic behavior, all of our economic ends are created through the market, through exchange with other people, money is half of every single transaction. It is the most critical enabler of that economy. Without money as a facilitator, you cannot have, like, barter produces one billionth of a possible market than one with a monetary standard does. So if you don't have a strong currency, if you don't have a currency you can use to purchase your soldiers, your weapons, your police, whatever it is, then you have nothing. And it doesn't matter that you demand taxes in that currency either. You can tax all you want, but if your policies are so bad that your money loses its fundamental value, nothing can save it. Venezuela is a perfect example. They're just as violent. They're more violent than they ever have been, but their currency is still worth crap. So unfortunately, almost every modern banking system, regulatory regime, and political institution believes and is espousing the same exact rhetoric that resulted in the current Venezuelan policies. It's a little scary, but at least to a milder degree, and the economy is so much larger and so much more interconnected that they can get away with it for much longer than Venezuela did. But here's another great section, is that if Bitcoin is truly a tilt at the state, and it is a external to the nation state, is a non-state institution that we intend and are building to resist the state and survive in spite of it for the long term, and that's what we are creating this technological and networking system to do, well, then what does that mean for altcoins? There's a quote that I absolutely love for this is, quote, "Given the immensity of this task and the existential threat that it poses to the state, only the most committed could possibly take up the cause. The great sin of altcoiners is not that they backed the wrong horse, but that they did so with insufficient conviction. They sold a dream that they themselves did not truly believe," end quote. So true. And he talks about, he hits it home in the article, is that the success for an altcoiner is a good exit. It's a pre-sale, a pump, and a dump, and that's it. Dumping on the hype cycle and altcoiners desperately holding onto bags, just hoping for someone else to buy it so that they can exit, is literally the story of 99% of altcoins and their supposed investors. And what's hilarious is I had no idea, but I actually read when he talks about like EOS, like EOS holding 140,000 Bitcoin, he links to an article, and I actually read the whole article because I was like, holy crap, EOS just has Bitcoin on its balance sheet. And this could not be a more important lesson to learn for everyone listening to this on the fifth anniversary of Bitstein's Everyone is a Scammer. which you can listen to on the most recent Noted podcast, or obviously the episode on my show. I'll link to the Noted podcast actually. And you know, if it happens that Michael Goldstein or Pierre or anybody listens, either one of them listens to this show, thank you so much. That was just so awesome, and I had no idea you were actually going to leave the commentary. I thought you are going to grab out the actual read. But I don't know, that was really great. And I know it's probably given me a lot more exposure, so I really appreciate that. But if anybody listening to this hasn't been to the Bitcoin conferences and you haven't met them, you gotta come hang out. Goldstein and Pierre are literally the nicest people in the world. All of their trolling on Twitter is absolutely a giant disguise. But EOS could not be a better example. Just prime, top-notch. Oh, the coin is successful. Look, it's still in the top 10. What are they holding on their balance sheet? Mountains and mountains of Bitcoin. They do not believe the dream they sold everybody else. And those questions that he poses, that we should be asking to our government and banking institutions, are a hundredfold more potently applied to just some garbage altcoin. Why do you get to mint currency? Why do you get some incredible position of control and power over what the rules of money are? What makes your shitcoin so different that it needs a completely unique system? We're going to ignore the thousands of alternatives, but they don't somehow fit your perfect prescription for what a money is. They have to have your control and direction. Where does anyone get the authority to do this? And how is it going to be made invulnerable, or at least deeply independent of political capture? The simple fact is they're all there because they want the power over money, the profit potential of the good with the highest total addressable market there is no equal anywhere in the world. Like, there is nothing as unbelievably profitable, which EOS could not be a better example of. They have 140,000 Bitcoin they won off of their scam. Think about it. Like, what a brilliant play. They'd made nothing. They didn't do anything. They made a pseudo-centralized crap coin and got one of the biggest balances of the most secure independent money in the world. And when he talks about, when Nick Carter talks about conviction in Bitcoin, that only the most committed could possibly take up the cause, you have to ask another question. Like, Bitcoin maximalism is not at odds with this. Bitcoin maximalism is a declaration of this. It is, I'm going to hold till the end because I have incredible conviction, and the end is not to get rich. The end is to create an extra state institution, an external to the state institution that is the final arbiter of financial ownership. Maximalists are not a bug. They are a feature. They are a critical piece of the puzzle for Bitcoin's success. It is the intolerant minority that will win by default, as Nassim Taleb says. And I love that. We talked about that just a little while ago, a couple episodes back. I can't remember which one. But talking about the minority rule, that if the altcoin A, B, and C are like, oh, we should be pro-innovation and we should all work together and we'll accept Bitcoin and altcoin A or Bitcoin and altcoin B, but then Bitcoiners are no. We will not accept anything but Bitcoin. Your altcoin A, B, and C are all crap. Well, then the Bitcoiners win by default because they are the only ones forcing a market standard or putting their individual stake on a market standard that they accept only. And I love the Nick Carter's idea of the altcoin, the idea of an altcoin maximalist world where everybody has their own coin. And it creates this ocean of pointless and high friction conversion between currencies, not just when you need to transfer money between countries, but every time you shop at one store versus another. and that we're all just going to have our own unique network features. And to get a feature, you have to do a Forex trade to some other currency. It's hilarious. Like it's absolutely ridiculous. It really is. All it is a regression of the market efficiency that a monetary good actually produces. You immediately have you're reinstating the double coincidence of wants problem into a virtual market for money, which is absurd because the one great utility of money is that it solves the double coincidence of wants problem. So to think that the market is then going to produce a double coincidence of wants of goods that are only there to solve double coincidence of wants is just stupid. It doesn't make any logical sense if you actually extend out from the basic idea of market competition, because a monetary good will always tend to one. Oh, I just remember what article it was that we talked about. This was Bitcoin Can't Be Copied. That was Parker Lewis's article. Man, I'm going to have so many things to link to in the show notes. Don't forget to check out that one if you have not heard it yet. Such a great topic, and you know we went at it. Parker Lewis has so many great pieces in his Gradually Then Suddenly series. Highly, highly recommend it. But there's another quote from Nick that he gets to, and I love this one too, because Bitcoin, even like just the idea of Bitcoin maximalism, so many people are just like, oh, it's anti-competitive. No, it's stake. It's putting your money where your mouth is, that there is going to be a winner in the competition of the best money, and that it is Bitcoin. And there is nobody saying you're going to be forced to use Bitcoin. And this quote was just great. Is that, quote, "You have the right, but not the obligation, to participate in the most transparent, auditable, debasement-free, and well-defined monetary system that the world has ever known." End quote. Gold. Just gold. And success in Bitcoin is not having to exit at all. We just talked about this on Monday's meetup this week, the Raleigh Bitcoin meetup, and it's so true. The quote-unquote normies who I speak to or whatever, who remember that, you know, I mentioned Bitcoin at some time and then they see it skyrocket, they always ask me, so are you going to cash out and, you know, put it in something? And I'm just like, I get that perspective. I totally understand it. And I know it's so hard to get around because I can see their perception of me. Like, I can stand in their shoes and they look at me as someone who is just totally in love with an investment, that I got paid a huge return, and what I should do as a smart investor is extract it back into the real economy or real money, and I'm just going to lose all my gains because I have become in love with my investment. I'm emotionally tied to it, and obviously, because I have had success so far, it will just take over the world and go up for infinity, and I will never sell, because And from their perspective, obviously this has run its course. It's just finding an equilibrium price, and now it's going to be done with the massive profit position that it has had in the market. But I'm not selling. And I know that looks crazy to most people, but Bitcoin is the end game of my investment strategy. Like, I am, the success of the system is that I will never have to exit. Now, I might take value out and put it in some other things to better my life, or particularly when it's a very life-changing amount, but it will not be dollars. I will not be going to dollars. It will be for some real-world resource or some other function. It'll be the very function that money serves. I will not be going to dollars outside of the fact that I may need to go to dollars first in order to get what I'm actually going for. But my money is Bitcoin. I will never go back to having no savings to fall back on. It has fundamentally changed my idea of savings, my idea of what it means to be stable or prepared for the future. And I will not be going back into debt just to get by. My spending habits have changed. My thinking about money have changed, and they've changed for good. I cannot properly see how there is any way to go back to my old way of thinking about things. And I don't know if that makes me smart or just flat crazy, but that's where I am. I partly, even though I get so excited about it and I am so emotionally attached to it, as you can tell with my rants, I partly do all of my reading. I constantly read things that like are against my opinion. I just don't read them on the show, and or that challenge my opinion. That's why I like having debates with people, because I think if I can't defend my ideas for myself, to myself, against a well-informed adversary, then I have to admit to myself, I have to realize that I don't know the full truth, that I am not accounting for certain information or certain incentives or aspects of the system that may completely alter what the results of what I believe are, where I am telling myself a current story and a current set of outcomes that, you know, are always based on limited knowledge, because I'm an individual. I can't, there's millions of times the information out there than can ever be consumed by even thousands of people. There is no, I am right, I've reached the end of knowledge. Okay, let's see. Oh, the best line in this whole article that I was like, just so sweet. Like, it hit every part. Like, I had to stop my recording and, like, dwell on this one for a second. Is, quote, "Capped supply is not a feature of Bitcoin. The supply cap is Bitcoin." Just straight fire. For everyone who does not get this, this is it. I never really put my finger directly on it, but this has been the key to something that I have known about Bitcoin for a very long time, and that is the simplest, most direct way to put it. The capped monetary supply, the monetary system itself, is Bitcoin. If that changes in any way, it is simply a different thing, period. I think the signature scheme could be completely altered, the features could be added, core flexibility could be increased or decreased in minor ways. All of those things I may still call Bitcoin regarding, or at least to the degree that it is enabling and enforcing the same ownership and the same supply schedule. But the monetary policy is the beating heart. It is the core value of what makes it a challenge to the systems it's replacing. It's what makes it an alternative that is entirely and fundamentally different to what the mainstream or what the status quo alternative is. Then we get into a section about Satoshi. And this is something, God, I've talked about it in so many times, and every time I recover this topic of the incredible, just the magic almost of Satoshi's story, of the origin story of Bitcoin, it just gets better and better. I want to figure out, there needs to be a way to tell this in just a magical, beautiful, like Promethean style story. But humanity, like us as humans, we relate to everything around us. We relate to our social systems. We relate to our friends and our families, our relationships, our environment. Everything is a story of what it means to us. And that's why telling someone a story about a character or a human story of a technology or of a lesson to learn, a moral lesson or something, has vastly more impact than explaining some technical detail or explaining some pattern or relationship. If you tell a human story, it will spread far and wide. If you just explain a lesson to somebody, it will sound like a lecture, it will carry no emotional weight, and most people won't listen to it. But that's what Satoshi's story is, just amazing. That Satoshi built the system entirely from scratch, released it and announced it to the world months before the network went live, kept the project alive in its infancy, helped maintain and nurture it through its early life, and then fully stepped away from the project and has left billions of dollars on the table, earned from his early stewardship, completely untouched. And he's anonymous. We have no idea who it is. It is just the... I mean, are you kidding? Are you kidding me? What an astounding story. And this quote is so beautiful. Quote, this is from Nick Carter's article. Satoshi daringly stole the state's most treasured possession, its right to unencumbered money creation, and gave it to the people in the purest way possible, end quote. Gah! I love this article. I love it so much. But you immediately, then we jump into the section of, well, why doesn't the state intervene, right? The truth, a ban would not stop Bitcoin. It just wouldn't. It would not shut down the system. It would not be of global concern because there would need to be a global cooperation in banning it. I mean, as Nick said, do we think we're going to see the U.S. and its allies making policy decisions and North Korea, Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, and everybody is just going to play along? Essentially enemies of these institutions would now have an open attack vector to do damage or weaken the United States in an indirect way. Because if we're talking about Bitcoin becoming a reasonable threat here, then that's what a policy ban would actually suggest, that they now have access to a sly roundabout way to dethrone the dollar and possibly even make an extraordinary amount of money in the process. I can't see every country giving that up so easily. And it could also mean, from their standpoint, of banning it on the surface, but mining and buying up reserves for a later retraction of that legal status in the future. So it doesn't even have to, it can look on the surface, but there can still be a war and a use of Bitcoin to threaten the hegemony of some other currency, obviously the dollar being a prime example here. In the background, that this could be done sneakily. It's not unheard of for governments to do exactly those sorts of things. And also remember that even in the U.S., regulations are very often entirely written, enacted, and enforced, start to finish, by unelected officials or institutions that are not ousted during an election cycle. These are external to the election process institutions. And that's about as wide open of a vulnerability as you can get. So when we're talking about a currency like Bitcoin that's made easily anonymous and censorship and is censorship resistant, what better tool for a personal in the dark, like, arbitrage play? So if not the regulators themselves, which bank is going to do it? Which corporation? Or government hiding behind some sort of corporation? Somebody is going to play the game to make boatloads of money on something like that in those billionaire social circles. But then again, he mentions that it also really shines a light on the perception of government's role. And Matt from Jason Stapleton's show that we did in previous crypto chat episode, I was on actual Jason Stapleton's show, but it's published in my feed. Matt brought it up as well, is that this really confuses or exposes what the government is actually up to or what its role actually is. Because we're currently witnessing a really, really serious breakdown in the status quo narrative. And Nick Carter says that he thinks everything is getting worse, and maybe he's right, I think, in like the political sense, but I think the reason everything is getting politically worse is a consequence of everything actually getting better at kind of the grassroots level. And maybe he thinks that as well, but I'll explain. So, like, the massive push that he talks about in the article to socialism and openly communist politicians, I truly think it's a result because of them actually losing a lot of their clout. I mean, Nick says in the article that journalists are reduced to like passing on just state messages in a futile effort to fight against media startups and YouTubers with like 1,000x their clout. And I think that's, again, I think they're having to cling to that because they are losing their clout, because there is this huge insurgent alternative media market that is breaking down what used to be one extremely widely held narrative, and it's breaking down into hundreds of narratives. It's breaking down into everyone is telling themselves a different story at a personal level. There is a lot less cohesion, and we're having a bit of a global identity crisis right now. It's not just the U.S. It's literally across the modern world that we're losing that political cohesion that we used to have. And I think a lot of people who feel desperate or feel like things are getting worse because of the loss of that collective identity, and because of that, they're latching on to the idea of socialism and far more stringent collectivist ideas, is because they're losing the power. There's no if you have political and social cohesion, you don't really have to cling to it so hard. It's like, well, we already really kind of have the dominant mindset, but when it starts getting challenged, when it starts to splinter into all of these different avenues, when you can't control the narrative because not everybody's watching the news anymore, because people are leaving those platforms in droves and seeking out different thought, that's when you have to cling to it. That's when you have to go that next level authoritarian, and you have to try to control the alternative platforms, and you have to fight against it because you're grabbing on to. It's like somebody realizing their relationship is falling apart. They get extra clingy. They get extra jealous and controlling. Like that's what happens. And I think it's a result of the relationship falling apart. We're losing that power center, that center of the narrative that we are all telling. And because of that, they're using far greater breadth of their power and their position in order to attempt to reinforce it as it starts to fall apart. Like I said, it's like a global identity crisis in a relationship that's breaking down, and everybody's getting really controlling and clingy and jealous. That's genuinely kind of how I see it. I think that's a great analogy personally. But when it kind of comes to that, when a government is, again, something that Matt talked about on Jason Stapleton's show, was that, well, look how ridiculous they look when they're afraid of a financial commodity. Doesn't expose them as just the controlling, parasitic person in this relationship that they actually are from their position. Like, what could, particularly when that commodity is deeply embracing the idea of openness and fairness, that it is saying, you are too corrupt, you are not open enough. When the actual dichotomy, it is only through ignorance that they can position Bitcoin as a less fair system. So when they're exposed as controlling and paranoid about just a financial tool, well, then using Bitcoin, that is the position that using Bitcoin has always been. That has always been Bitcoin's position, is escaping the arrogance and arbitrary authority of the state and corporate institutions. So it does is reinforce what Bitcoin is needed for. It's like, holy crap, I really do need Bitcoin. I really do need to get around the political whims of the capricious state. And so it only reinforces exactly the dominant use or the dominant utility of the Bitcoin system as an alternative to the state. As the state becomes more paranoid and more controlling, Bitcoin looks more and more necessary to a greater demographic of people across the globe. And it's always there. That's the most beautiful thing about the whole article, and his conclusion is that it's not going anywhere. It's already positioned itself as in that narrative. It's already very strongly serving that narrative in places in like Venezuela, Argentina, and Zimbabwe. They're not going to give two shits if their country bans Bitcoin or not. They have to have it to survive. And there is a exploding underground market for it. Specifically because of that, it is the only way that you can get the black market price of the currency when the official rates are garbage, when they're just by decree. So as the pool of currencies in terrible and declining situations is growing, it's not getting smaller. It is only going to grow. It's not. I can't think of one currency in the modern fiat financial system that is that has anything anywhere to go but down right now. Like, the whole thing is deeply interconnected, reliant on each other, and all the currencies are in a bad situation. Debts are bad everywhere across the board. So there will be many more countries added to the list of Venezuela, Argentina, and Zimbabwe. And it will, obviously, I think it will inevitably happen with the smaller countries. It will be a cascading effect, a domino effect that goes up the ladder from small countries to big countries, or small currencies to big currencies. But the number of people that will begin to completely lose respect and trust in their country's currency is going to increase. I don't see any way that trend declines or stops. You know, it could be the euro. Could be the British pounds. We've got Brexit and all that fiasco happening right now. Could be the yuan, the Indian rupee. It could be the dollar. It's going to eventually be the dollar, I think. I don't see any way that we get out of our current imbalance without a massive devaluation of the currency. And all of the other ones are tied. I mean, they're backed by the dollar. So what happens when we have, you know, a cascading bond crisis? What happens when, I mean, negative interest rates all over the place? What happens when people's pensions start to evaporate during a credit default? What happens with the student loan bubble? What about our wonderfully reinflated housing bubble or the stock market bubble? What happens when any of these start to teeter in a significant way, when the cracks of these foundations start to be exposed, and they start the process into their painful and long overdue market corrections? What, is everybody just going to be like, oh man, oh shucks, that sucks, I really wanted to retire? And they're just going to sit and just take it up the rear? These things are going to start moving together, and these systemic problems are tying it all to the same giant sinking Titanic, and people will be desperate for an exit. And Bitcoin will be there. Bitcoin will remain present for the entire thing. And I personally think that because Bitcoin is the only true alternative market that is external to the state apparatus and the deeply connected failures of the string of collapsing dominoes of the financial system, since Bitcoin is the only truly external thing to this, that a bet against Bitcoin is a bet for the long-term stability and the successful outcome of global negative interest rates across many trillions of dollars worth of assets. The absurdity of that. The global economy is so shockingly over-leveraged and exhausted of actual resources that the money manipulators are actually paying financial institutions to borrow money. That this is being casually normalized across the majority of the modern world should scare the shit out of anyone with more than $100 wrapped up into the modern banking system. I keep the absolute minimum amount of money outside of Bitcoin as I can possibly manage. And I make sure it is either spent very quickly on useful consumption goods or some other like real world thing, or that it is back behind my private keys as soon as possible. And people say, don't put any more into Bitcoin than you're willing to lose. Well, I get that to some extent when we're talking about it as an investment. But I think there is another thing to consider, that it is equally important to remember not to keep any more money in the bank and fiat currency than you're willing to lose. There is no riskless safe haven in this economy right now. In the financial world, it is all exposed to some risk. And the idea that the dollar is not a risk, and that keeping money in a large banking institution is not a risk, is to ignore the risk that is actually there. And Bitcoin is going to be there. As all of this comes to a head, even with some sort of ban or concerted effort to attack it, like a giant political campaign against it, I truly think Bitcoin will not be stopped. It won't be shut down, because it just can't be. You know, there may be some incredibly powerful attack, and we've seen a lot of attacks, and we've seen ways that it can be undermined, but I think it would require such a profound and focused effort, and it would be specifically the need to attack Bitcoin would specifically be during a time when I think all of these institutions will have an enormous amount of growing other problems on their hands. So if we're talking about Bitcoin is beginning to squeeze itself into a position where it threatens large national currencies and banking and corporate control, understand that the purchasing power of these governments and institutions will be falling as Bitcoin increases, as Bitcoin grows. So at a certain size, Bitcoin could very well be the catalyst that puts pressure on many of these markets and imbalances to correct them sooner than they otherwise may have been or may have been forced to do. The facade is really easy to maintain in a world where all fiat currencies are falling at the same time, but a financial world with Bitcoin may make it a lot more difficult to tell a lie about what the price of said money is. Venezuela and Argentina are learning that lesson right now. I suspect sanctions and controls being forced on Iranians and the Yemeni population are going to be learning the same thing very soon, and they will not be the last ones to do so. Man, I still have more to say. I'm gonna wrap it up though. We're I've gone way too long here. This is gonna be a crazy long episode, and it's taken me 2 days to really put this together. So we're just going to end it with. I just want to read the last paragraph again of the article. So if you haven't listened to it, I'm gonna spoil the end. So shame on you for not listening to Nick Carter's article. But I quote, "You may deride Bitcoin. No matter. Bitcoin will be there for you when you need it. You may not need it now. You may not need it ever. But as we plunge into a more despotic, authoritarian, and chaotic world, you may one day feel comfort knowing that the world's highest assurance wealth protection system in history is waiting patiently for you. Until then, it will keep ticking along." And what a better way to end today's episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. I also want to give a shout out. We have got two new sponsors to the show. I already thanked Maximilian on one of the previous episodes, but another huge thank you to Maximilian. And then we have also got Cameron and David Warren, new patrons to this show, supporting the work of turning all the most amazing Bitcoin pieces into the audio versions they deserve, and then expanding and educating on all of these concepts. Thank you guys so much. And if anybody wants to join us in the Crypto Economy Telegram group and also support the work that I am doing, I would love for you to join us. We have so much fun over there. And it is patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy. And of course, follow me at The Crypto Economy. And check out, you got to drop, if you didn't remember to drop some applause on Nick Carter's excellent article yesterday, or I guess the day before now, you got to go do it. Take a break. Take a couple minutes. Follow me on Twitter. Follow Nick Carter on Twitter and drop some applause on that article. I love you guys. Thank you so much for joining me. I am Guy Swan signing out for today. I may have, may drop some a little more fun stuff just before we roll into the weekend or over the weekend. But I've got lots of recording happening in the background. Got a couple of big announcements coming soon. So thank you. Thank you so much for being patient with me. And I will catch you all later. Until then, take it easy, guys.